Welcome to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires, politics editor at The Sun. The post office is cutting costs, and it could mean that Las Vegas-style mail delivery spreads to the rest of the nation. Las Vegas Sands CEO Sheldon Adelson has long feuded with Congresswoman Shelley Berkley, and it could play into the state's high-profile Senate race. We'll find out why. But first, the long-running battle over taxes has been placed on hold for the foreseeable future. So writes David McGrath Schwartz, who covers the state capitol for The Sun. David joins us now. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
Why do you say that this battle's on hold?
Actually, I think I was stronger than on hold. I said it's over. The advocates for higher taxes are waving the white flag. And you're right, for the foreseeable future is what they're saying. The legislative process where two-thirds is required of lawmakers to pass a tax frustrated people last session and this session. There was a lot of hope at the beginning to get a coalition together to put a tax on the ballot. That just never happened. And so, you know, it really has been the definitive fight for the past 10 years in policy circles, which is, you know, taxes and spending. You know, does government have enough? Does education have enough? And for now, it's over. The issue's dead for 2013, probably through 2015, at least.
Okay, so 2013, that's a little easier to forecast what's going to be coming next year when the legislature meets again. But how can you say into 2015?
Well, if you look at the makeup of the legislature and how the votes are, it's very unlikely that Democrats are able to get two-thirds this year or next time around when they have a lot of incumbents who are up for re-election. It's going to be very difficult for them to get to the two-thirds magic number. Also, you have the governor. The governor is running for re-election, has campaigned on this promise not to raise taxes, and now sort of subtly shifted to saying no one's taxes are going to be higher today than they were when I came into office. And that seems to be his new line in the sand. You have some divisiveness in the gaming industry, which has traditionally supported a broad business tax. You know, some of the players there are more conservative, like Wynn and Steve Wynn and Sheldon Adelson, the head of Wynn and Las Vegas Sands, respectively.
So you said people were frustrated at the legislature last time, a year ago, because they just saw no feasible way to put a tax through because you couldn't get to that two-thirds bar that's
required.
Yeah,
and it's this sense of, let no crisis go wasted, right? So you had these big budget cuts. You had a lot of moving stories about cuts in services and the potential of cuts. You had state workers who studies show aren't overpaid, getting their salaries cut, and there was just no political will to do it. So the feeling is, if you couldn't get it passed in that state, if you couldn't utilize this crisis to get a tax passed, then when can you?
But wouldn't you could certainly make the argument the other way, that people were least capable of affording taxes right in the heart of a recession, and that now, as it looks like, maybe things are starting to resolve themselves economically in the state, that perhaps there might be a little more play in the rope. So,
and that's a great argument, and certainly, you know, economists I talk to, even ones on the left side, will readily admit that raising taxes in a recession is a bad idea. The issue is that when you're climbing out of the recession, the same argument is used that you don't want to kill the recovery by raising taxes at that point. if you go back to 2003 and you know, when Las Vegas was booming, that the statement was, you can't raise taxes now, you're going to slow down growth, you're going to kill growth. I think no one's predicting that we're going to have another boom or another explosion like we did last time, but there is this sense that the moment has passed.
So the initiative process was seen as kind of the release valve here, you know, or a way, I guess, a detour around the legislature.
Right.
Why is that not going to work?
You know, I'm not sure that I fully understand what happened there. Basically, you have two lines of thought here. One is that labor has taken a heavy hand and misplayed it, you know, pushed too hard, was too inflexible with some of the interest groups, be it the teachers or be it gaming, wanted too much control over how the process was run. And I'm talking about the AFL-CIO, which is headed by Danny Thompson, longtime player in Nevada politics. Another thought is that, gaming of today is not gaming of 10 years ago, where you had MGM and Harrah's as the big boys in the block. The companies that are making money right now are Wynn and Sands, who are making a lot of money in Macau, and frankly aren't as open to a broad-based tax as, Caesars, as it's called now, instead of Harrah's and MGM, which is, not in the same financial position that it was during the boom.
You mentioned the AFL-CIO. They had wanted to raise $1 billion for schools, for education,
right. Yeah.
I guess, more broadly than just K-12 schools, and wanted to go to the ballot and do that. They couldn't get the support of teachers. Gaming and mining had been seen as potential allies because this was going to be a broad-based business tax, meaning a tax on businesses other than the mining industry and the gaming industry, which have traditionally carried the lion's share of the state budget. So what happened there?
And they'd say, well, they'd pay that tax too, and they would. They just don't want to be singled out is sort of their argument. And look, it's very possible that the AFL-CIO proves me a fool. They wouldn't be the first or the last to do so. And they file their initiative, and they can collect the signatures using all volunteers and mount a public campaign based on the, appealing to Nevadans' better nature. It just hasn't happened in the past without some well-funded resources.
Right. It usually takes a hefty campaign, meaning some deep pockets behind it, and at this point it doesn't look like that kind of ally has stepped forward to participate on this. So absent that, what do we see then coming out of the session? What taxes do take place?
Anjanette talked about
some political writer, Anjanette Damon, you mean?
Yeah, I'm sorry. How many Anjanettes do you know? I didn't know. I thought she was like Cher. But you're going to have a lot of attention focused on mining and the mining tax, and it won't yield immediate money. People who are anti-mining or at least want to target them want to yank their tax out of the Constitution so that lawmakers can fuss around with it on a yearly basis and, frankly, increase it. And so that's going to get a lot of attention. I'm hearing rumblings that there are going to be some efforts, maybe quixotic, to raise the gaming tax. I'm just not sure with the politics where any of it's going to go right now.
You're listening to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires. We're speaking with David McGrath Schwartz. He's covers the state capitol for the Las Vegas Sun. David, you've written this week about Amazon, the online retailer, seller of all things, seemingly, is going to start paying sales tax to the state of Nevada starting in 2014.
Right.
How did this come about?
Well, they're going to start collecting the sales tax. This came about, the traditional brick-and-mortar stores and their lobbyists have been pushing for legislation to require them to collect this sales tax for some time now, and Amazon has been resistant to that. When you walk into a store, you know, Michael Squire's T-shirt shop, and you buy a T-shirt, in Clark County you pay 8.1% at the cash register there. On Amazon, you have not been paying that. The state and the retailers have said that, well, it's the responsibility of the buyer. And I'm sure, Michael, every time you've bought a T-shirt on Amazon, you've gone to the tax department, downloaded a form, and filled it out, and sent your 81-cent check on a $10 shirt into
unfailingly.
The tax department,
I do it just not to spend the money, but just because I like to do the paperwork. It's exhilarating.
You know, brick and mortar stores have argued that it's an issue of fairness, and you know, we're shortchanging our schools and education. This deal, though, follows deals with other states. Like California reached the deal in 2011 for the retailer to start collecting sales tax there. Of course, they're going to start collecting in 2012. In Nevada, Amazon isn't going to start collecting that tax until January 1st, 2014, or when federal legislation gets passed, whichever is first. Which to me is sort of a interesting question about Nevada's. You know, we are considered more business friendly than our partners or our friends to the west, or our frenemies to the west, and you know, they're starting to collect the tax in 2012. Nevada not until 2014. And that seems pretty interesting to me.
Frenemies to the west. Is this going to extend to other internet retailers then? Is that
It's not right now.
My question is, why does there have to be a specific agreement with Amazon? Why can't the state say, we're going to begin collecting, you need to start collecting sales tax on the sales you do to residents of Nevada, just as if you went to Target or Walmart or whatever and bought a similar item.
Right. It actually goes back to the days of the Sears catalog. Way back when, and there's some case law about what kind of nexus is drawn. Do they need to have what kind of presence do they need to have in the state if they don't have a retail location? So it's sort of a gray area of the law that it's seen, you know, you either take the carrot or the stick approach. I like to think of a carrot being used as a stick, just more for my own amusement,
yes,
rather than to illustrate any larger point. But, you know, Nevada has always tried to work with its businesses in many ways.
We are business friendly, David. They agree to start collecting it in 2014. Is part of that, you think, that they are an employer here? They have Zappos is a subsidiary or a unit of Amazon.
Yeah, and in
and they have
Northern
a distribution
Nevada
center
and,
up there.
Yeah, we got big distribution centers up here.
So you can only play so tough, right?
What was that, Michael?
So the state only wants to play so tough, not wanting to alienate the company.
I think so, and you know, I think the governor has made it clear he wants to work with these businesses and do that. So, you know, I think it is part of the calculation here.
David McGrath-Schwartz covers the state capitol for the Las Vegas Sun and does a fabulous job with it. David, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure working with you for a long time. Las Vegas will be worse without you. And we'll miss you in Arizona.
You too. Take care, David.
Thanks, Michael.
You're listening to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. We're speaking with Anjanette Damon, the Sun's lead political writer. Anjanette, how much spending do they expect in the Heller-Berkley race?
Well, I haven't really seen a number tied to that, but it's expected to be significant. Not only will Dean Heller and Shelley Berkley and their campaign spend a lot of money on this race, but you're going to see a lot of outside involvement in this race. You're going to see super PACs spending money here. You're going to see the Senate committees spending a lot of money here. This is one of a handful of races in the country that could determine which party controls the Senate. Now, part of the danger for Sheldon Adelson is, or maybe not a danger, but an issue, is when you have so many groups playing, there's only so much TV time that you can buy. And so he's going to be likely crowded out. And once all these different groups saturate the airwaves, one, it's difficult to buy airtime, and two, it just kind of dilutes any individual donor's effectiveness in this race. So, you know, Democrats will argue that, hey, if it's not Sheldon Adelson spending money in this race, it's going to be the Koch brothers with AFP, or it's going to be Karl Rove's Crossroads Group, or it's going to be the Republican Senate Committee. So they, you know, they're trying to shift the focus and say, even if Sheldon Adelson spends a lot of money here, if he wasn't, it would be some other group. So don't put, you know, outweigh the significance of whatever money he's going to spend.
And you've already mentioned this, but the dynamic is interesting how on Israel, both are as ardent a defender of Israel as far as U.S. policy goes, referring to Shelley Berkley and Sheldon Adelson. And yet they are quite, I don't know, polar opposites, but certainly at odds on a lot of the other issues, probably involvement of unions in the workplace. Sheldon Adelson has had, labor in his crosshairs for some time. And observers or people who know the two of them say what the issues were that caused this relationship to break down? Was it some of those political disagreements, or were there personal issues as well, or did at some point they just kind of all became mixed together and it didn't matter?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. It just kind of all became mixed together. I've talked to a couple of people whose memories go back that long. So yeah, there were political differences, and then it just, you know, it kind of spiraled into these personal feelings among the two. And it is a little bit ironic that, you know, Sheldon Adelson is going to be spending money against, you know, Israel is near and dear to his heart, is probably one of the most important issues that he has. And Shelley Berkley is right in line with him on those. But they do disagree vehemently on the labor issue. Sheldon Adelson has long been an anti-union crusader. Shelley Berkley gets tremendous support from the unions for her political campaigns. And that was another thing that Democrats brought up is, look, if this becomes a Shelley Berkley versus Sheldon Adelson race, that's just going to further excite the union base for Shelley Berkley. Not that they probably will need too much, you know, prompting there to support her. But if it does become that race, you're going to see a lot more intense support, I think, from unions for Shelley Berkley.
Anjanette Damon is The Sun's lead political writer. Anjanette, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
You're listening to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires. And joining us now is Karin Demirjian, the Sun's Washington correspondent. Karin, over the weekend you wrote a story about money trouble at the post office. It seems to be the only news story that ever comes out of the post office these days. But one of the things that you've noticed is that Las Vegas-style mail delivery could be exported to the rest of the country or become more of the norm in the rest of the country. Why is that?
Well, basically, they need to find some way to get a large stash of cash real quick because the post office is so in the red right now and is losing an extra $5 billion a year. So there's basically three main ways that they're proposing to do that. One is to change the way that the pension system and the health care benefits for retirees is paid out and paid in. Another is to eliminate Saturday delivery because that would be a sixth of the delivery days they have going right now and mean fewer workers. And another way, and this is the way that's most relevant to Las Vegas, where Las Vegas is becoming kind of a model for the country, is to centralize the delivery of mail. In Las Vegas, people are pretty used to having those neighborhood distribution units, which are those aluminum boxes that are, you know, at the end of the block or wherever it is in your neighborhood where you walk from your house to that spot to pick up your mail. That's not the way it works in the middle of the country, and definitely not the way it works in the East Coast. I'm in Washington, D.C. The way my mail comes in is it slid through my door and it goes plop on the floor. And you can just think about the difference in delivery. I mean, if you're a post office walking from door to door, walking up every doorway, putting the mail on the slot, walking back and doing that for a block on each side before you get back in your truck, it takes a lot longer than the mail worker in Las Vegas, who's driving up, dumping everything in, boom, 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 and going. And that is money, because it's people's wages and work hours that are being paid. That's, of course, why there's also a lot of pushback, because nobody wants to talk about, you know, everyone wants to talk saving money. No one wants to talk about cutting jobs and cutting expenses that are related to jobs, which is what you'd end up doing.
So exactly how much more costly? I'm sure they've probably run some numbers on that. Do they have an idea of that?
There was an estimate made last year. The Office of the Inspector General put out an audit report that guessed that it would be, if you change the door-to-door deliveries to mailboxes on the curb, that would save $4.5 billion up front. And if you change the curb deliveries to these sorts of centralized mailboxes, that would save another $5.1 billion. So it's anywhere between $4.5 and $9.5 billion that might be saved on an annual basis for making that switch.
And how much of the post office financial needs would that address? How much are they in the hole or forecast to be in the hole?
Well, I mean, they were in the hole before this past year, I think $10 billion, and now they're definitely add another $5 billion, and we don't know yet what the outcome of fiscal 2012 is, because the only final numbers we have is fiscal 2011. But they're hemorrhaging the money pretty quick.
But certainly a significant amount of money, really almost the entire deficit that they're running.
Right, exactly. Right, but the tension is that the workers for the Postal Service would say, don't cut our days, don't cut our staff positions, change the way that we've been paying into our retiree system, because there, you'd save just about the same amount of money. You'd save about $5.5 billion a year, whereas they're adding about $5 billion a year to their debt. And so they're saying that's something that we can agree with, that everybody can get behind, and then you won't be cutting jobs, and you won't be slashing middle-class livelihoods. And we'd rather you do that than take these other proactive steps. But the bill basically puts them all on the table. Not immediately. It would be, they'd kick in the next 2 and 3 years. But it's up for discussion, because they're not sure if the Postal Service is going to keep hemorrhaging money. I mean, the more people go to the internet, the more options there are out there for cheaper delivery. And, you know, with there's more competition with the private servers, it gets cheaper. The less attractive the Postal Service is, and so far they haven't rebounded that much based on the losses they had the last few years. And if things get worse, what are you going to do? You need more money to pay for the discrepancy. And right now, what the Postal Service workers want to do basically matches the money they're losing. It would put them back in the black eventually, but maybe not as fast as people in Congress want.
So in 10 seconds, how quickly will this all sort itself out?
Well, they're doing quite a lot of votes on it this week, but the Senate and the House don't agree about what they're supposed to be doing, so they could be kicking it back and forth between each other for quite a while, but there's a hard deadline of May 15th. If they don't come up with something by May 15th, the moratorium on some of these closures and changes ends, and the Postmaster General can start to do whatever he wants, and then it's anybody's guess how long it'll take to iron out the mess that may follow.
Karen DeMerchant is the Sun's Washington correspondent. Karen, thank you.
Thank you.
You can follow Karin's coverage and the rest of the Sun Politics team at lasvegassun.com/politics. I'm Michael Squires. Goodbye, Las Vegas.